Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Hi, everybody. Glad to see so many turning out to welcome Russell Banks with his latest book, Lost Memory of Skin, and the cover is fabulous if you haven't seen it. There was a great article in The New Yorker, but I couldn't get to it today, so take a look at that. He was born in Newton, Mass., and raised in a small town of Barnstead, New Hampshire. The son of Earl and Florence Banks, his mom, Florence, was a storyteller in the family and often enthralled the children with her made-up day. But it was still scintillating. He still paints and writes poetry occasionally. He was a good student, and this is very interesting, winning the full scholarship to Colgate University. He dropped out in his first year with the intention of joining Fidel Castro's insurgent army in Cuba. I love that. But wound up working in a department store in Lakeland, Florida. Then he went on to briefly live in Boston, where he began to write fiction and poetry before returning to New Hampshire in 1964, soon after he entered the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we're certainly glad he picked up his writing. So let's welcome him and hear more about this wonderful book.
That's very, very sweet of you to sort of outline my youth, my wasted youth. It wasn't all wasted. No youth is wasted. I like to say sometimes no love is wasted. It's not something you can quantify. And in the same sense, I suppose no youth is wasted because you can't quantify it. It stays with you forever. We never quite grow up, I guess, in some way. And maybe this book kind of proved that back to me again and again all these years later. It's a pleasure, great pleasure to be here and to be in this legendary bookstore. I mean, it really is for people like myself, for writers. This is what we mean when we talk about bookstores. And I'm delighted to be here, really honored to be here. Grateful that you're still here. And apparently thriving, although I haven't looked at the bottom line of what's going on in you. But it's great. It's great. It's wonderful. What I'd like to do is just kind of talk about this book, Lost Memory of Skin, a little bit in a way that I'm still learning how to do. It's a complicated process. For those of you who are writers, and I see a couple of people here who are and whom I know, and you know how difficult it is to talk about, especially a novel, we call a literary novel, a novel not written for any observable purpose, certainly no financial purpose. What the heck do you say about it, and how do you describe it? And it's an increasingly difficult thing to do, I think, in some ways, because the media, and I say this because I'm now in the fourth week of a six-week book tour, and I've been traveling across the country and engaging the public media over and over again. The media have a hard time grasping how to how to interview you, how to talk about what it is you've done, whatever it is you've done. When the writer has to kind of figure out how to talk about it in response and in a way that's humane and not cruel or superficial just reject the question. The question which keeps coming up with regard to this book and which begins most of the discussion that I've had is like, why did you choose to write about homeless convicted sex offenders? As if a novel were about something. as if there were a subject, and you were an investigative journalist, and or a sociologist, or a historian, or a psychologist, or as if you had a subject, you know. In a way, storytellers don't have a subject. All they have is a story. And it's very difficult to kind of change the subject and bring the subject of the interview or the discussion back around when you're talking about a novel and say, well, it isn't really about anything. It doesn't have a subject. It has a kind of collision, an encounter, something which occurred to me and in my imagination at some point in my life. And I didn't choose it. It seemed to have chosen me. And then it resulted in a novel. And now I have to go out and talk about it from an entirely different perspective, the perspective of the reader, or more often is the case, except in occasions like tonight and when I can actually meet people who are readers, more often is the case, it's a journalist or a critic or a reviewer or something like that. And it's a very difficult thing to do. And I'm still learning how to do it at this advanced age, the stage of my career, and also the book having been published already was published in late September. So I should have a little experience and distance at doing it. And I'm finding myself still, nonetheless, somewhat awkward in presenting the book and talking about the book. The best thing I can do, I think, in talking about it is to kind of talk about its origins and how it chose me, because that is how I experience it and how I experience most of my work, is that I'd like to write a novel about homeless convicted sex offenders. That's a really good subject. I bet everybody in America is interested in that one. And maybe they're trapped under a causeway in South Florida somewhere, and you know they can't go within 2,500 feet of wherever children gather, so there's no place in the city they can live, and they're all down there together, these serial rapists and these kind of old drunks who just got arrested for indecent exposure, and some 20-year-old kid who had sex with his 16-year-old girlfriend and they got arrested for statutory rape, and now they're all down there together. That's a good subject. I can get that one on Oprah. I can't really move that one. No, you don't do it that way. And it didn't happen that way. And I know that's true for any writer who's a serious writer. It doesn't happen that way. I spend 6 months a year. I live in upstate New York 6 months a year, way up in the corner near Lake Champlain, where Vermont and New York and Quebec come together. And the temperature drops to zero in July, and it's really a cold but beautiful, beautiful spot. And I live there 6 months, and then I live in Miami Beach 6 months. And I'm sure I don't have to say which 6 months that I live in Miami Beach. As I've gotten older, the darkness descends, and depression comes with it, and then I say, I'm getting out of here, I'm heading for Miami, and I do. And I have a condominium down there that looks out. It's on Miami Beach, and it looks out over Biscayne Bay at the Miami skyline, which is so wonderfully telegenic. And you see it in the intro material to CSI Miami every night, every time it shows. And it's gorgeous. And then there is this causeway which connects the two, Miami Beach to the mainland. The Julia Tuttle Causeway crosses over, and I can see it from my terrace, and I sit out there and look out, and it's just this gorgeous, splendid view. And about 4 years ago, articles started appearing in the Miami Herald about a colony of, as they called it, and it was indeed, of convicted sex offenders living under that causeway overpass. And with the connivance and policy, really, of law authorities, law enforcement in Miami-Dade County and politicians and so forth. I mean, it was known to them, and it was a policy, and it was a result of a regulation which required anyone convicted of a sex offense of whatever degree, first, second, or third degree, was forbidden from living within 2,500 feet of wherever the children might gather. And so they were all there together. Psychopathic serial rapists, as I said, side by side with poor, pathetic people who might have stumbled drunkenly into indecent exposure, got convicted for that, and then they were sent up, or some kid who got convicted of statutory rape, he got sent up, and here they were all together, clustered under this bridge in a kind of shanty town that they had built together, where they had to keep their anklets because they're all wearing GPS guided anklets, electronic anklets. They had to keep the batteries charged all the time, or they would have broken terms of their parole and been sent back to prison. And they could never leave the county because of the terms of their parole. And they were making a life for themselves down there. And there were at one time up to 100 men living down there. Most of the time it was between 40 and 50, but they were up to 100. I could look out on from my terrace and see this causeway and imagine these men down there. And I began to imagine a kid, some dumb kid, some poor, pathetic, screwed up loser kid, the kind of kid I think of as a kind of feral child, someone who just raised himself, essentially, someone who's got a single, we used to call a latchkey kid when I was younger, but a kid who's essentially raised himself with a single parent who goes to work in the morning after putting the frozen toasties in the toaster and heads out, and then the kid goes out and he comes back, she comes back at 6 or 7 o'clock. She's bored, she's tired, she's young, she's only 30 or whatever. She goes out 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, she comes back. Maybe she's got a boyfriend, maybe she doesn't. The kid is on the internet, clicking onto porn sites, whatever. But he's losing himself into this digitalized world. And it was so easy for me to imagine someone emerging out of this world, that it drew me toward a kind of mystery, the mystery of sexual predation, pedophilia, of all the crimes that all these men are convicted of and are paying their dues for, and the history of it, the psychology of it, the legal apparatus that surrounds it, both before and during and after they're arrested and convicted and serve their time. All of this emerged out of the world at large, the world that was I could see from my terrace, started to become very mysterious and irresistible to me. I couldn't back away from it. I am a kind of writer, and I think most serious writers, fiction writers, are the same type, who subscribes to what Flannery O'Connor said in describing her own work. He says, what I want to do is I want to penetrate what is mysterious to me and take it so far that I'm confronted with another mystery. And that's exactly what the ground rules for my own kind of enterprise is. And this was one of those mysteries that was emerging in front of me that I hadn't expected, hadn't wanted particularly. Like most Americans, it was a subject and a population, really, that I hadn't any interest in, except in a kind of, I don't know, clinical way? Not even clinical. Couldn't have been that. Just sociological, maybe. Nah, I was just a consumer of the news that has appeared in the papers every day. Another horrendous story about some abduction and some awful thing, and I would tend to lump everybody together out there. Well, this didn't happen in my family. Well, frankly, I had to think about it for a minute. Yeah, it did. I'm the father of 4 daughters, and one of them was abused as a child. Also, my wife was abused as a child. And I had to start kind of turning myself around and thinking about it, that very close to me, I have women whose life experience is in some ways shaped and defined by the fact that they were themselves victims of sexual abuse. And my wife, who some of you may know her work, she's a poet, and she's written about it, so I feel easy talking about it. And her name is Chase Twitchell, and she's written about it in numerous of her poems. So this was suddenly emerging as a very significant mystery to me. Even though I had dealt with it on a kind of familial level, I had never really dealt with it from the point of view of the perp, you know, from the point of view of the perpetrator of this, always from the point of view of the victim. And with the obvious and inescapable and necessary sympathy. But wait a minute, who are these people? Who are these men, boys, whoever they are, and so on? So out of that began to emerge a character. And once the character kind of emerged, then the rest of it just kind of circulated around that, and the story began to unfold. And a character who is the center of the novel, called The Kid, began to control my life, as it turned out, for the next 3 years of my life. And then the book emerged. So you can see the difficulty I therefore have when someone says, what's this, you know, this book about, and why did you write a book about X or Y or Z? Well, no, it's not that simple. It's much more complicated than that. And in the end, after all, it is a story. And the kid appears very early, and I think he's a sympathetic character. I certainly felt great sympathy for him. I'd like to separate the terms that we often use together as if they were meant the same thing, sympathy and identify with. I don't identify with my characters much at all. I rarely identify with them. In fact, I've never written about a character that I identify with, because I've never written about myself. In fact, that's part of my intention as a writer, is to avoid that and to write about people who are other than I am and who are different from me in as much as possible, because that's what's mysterious to me. I'm not mysterious to myself, but convicted sex offenders are mysterious to me. And so the novel enters the world of the kid, engages it with a big embrace, I must say, and begins to unfold. As I described the kid briefly to you earlier, he's a lost soul, but he's also a soul with a very narrow perspective on the world. One of those kids who gets through high school with the minimal skill set, barely literate, screws up at everything, is alienated and lonely, and has no narrative for his life, has no linkage between his own experience, the cells of his own experience. They only exist as kinds of episodes, disconnected episodes. And who is addicted to pornography and the internet from the age of about 11. And there are some other aspects of his life, too, which are important in the novel. He, from the age of 11, has raised an iguana named Iggy, after Iggy Pop, for those of you who care about such things. And I love the Iggy Pop, and Iggy Pop, the fact that Iggy Pop is named Iggy after his first band called the Iguanas. His real name was something like Jack Rosenquist or something like that, from New Jersey. But anyhow, the kid names his iguana and raises this iguana, and this becomes his essential contact to any other, his main bond to, and his only access to tenderness. And to caring comes through his relation to this iguana. Thus, the iguana has the cover of the book. He's a significant image in a way. And the iguana is like the kid in some ways. I don't want to make too big a deal out of it, because I didn't think of it at the time. You know, you don't place these images into a novel as if they were raisins and bread or something like that. You know, you say, oh, yeah, an iguana. That'd be cool. You know, I remember the reason the iguanas in the novel is because I was sitting in a cafe outside on Lincoln Road in Miami Beach, and this incredibly gorgeous woman walked in, looking really cool, with an iguana on a leash, and I just thought, whoa, I'd like to talk to that iguana. And, I knew it was an attention-getting device, and it was supposed to go the other way, that you were supposed to want to talk to her. And so I talked to her, but in order to talk to her iguana, I really wanted to meet the iguana. And it turned out the iguana was this extraordinarily interesting, fascinating creature to me. And a gentle and sweet and intelligent creature. It's a vegetarian, if anybody's concerned about iguanas. They look dangerous. They look like they would eat your arm. But in fact, they don't want anything. The spinach leaves and things like that. And they look, antediluvian in some awful way. And they get to be about 4 feet long and weigh about 30 pounds. I just fell in love with the idea and the image of an iguana. At this time, I was already working with this material and writing this book. I need an iguana in this book. And a kid has to love the iguana, and he has to know more about iguanas than any other human being knows about iguanas. So it became part of my research. And there's a long chapter in here about iguanas, if any of you are interested in iguanas, because they're a very interesting creature in many, many ways. Anyhow, I've gone on a little too long, and I've told you too much almost, perhaps, but about the novel. Some of you may have already read it, and so I'm sure it's redundant, much of what I'm saying. But what I'd really like to do is hear from you and take questions and so on. And then as we get to the end, what time is it now? Okay, so we have about 20 minutes where we can talk together. And then I'd just like to close with a paragraph or two read from the book that I think kind of pulls things together in a way that is useful to me to give back to you. So I would like to turn the evening for about 20 minutes or so over to you and take questions, yeah?
Can you repeat the question?
It's being podcast. Sure, I can. I'll repeat it, yeah. Yes.
So you write about this kid who's obviously a person quite different than you. Totally different background, different frame of mind, somebody who, maybe was consumed by the internet, or was probably consumed in the world of books and ideas growing up, I don't know. But so how do you tell his story? Do you tell his story through his viewpoint? How do you talk about him? How do you learn to do that? What's the learning process?
Well, oh, God, that's almost an impossible question to answer. The question is how do you know about, if I can rephrase it, how do you know about the inner life of somebody who is so unlike you, who's so different from you? And I'm not sure how to answer it except to point to a few things, I guess. When I first started working in films, decade or so ago, more than that now, 15 years ago, I got involved with filmmaking and through the adaptations of some of my own books. And I used to think that the novelist was most like the director. That's right. The novelist is in charge. Novelist invents everything. Novelist controls everything. We do the scenery. We do the camera work. We cast it. We do everything. We write the script. We do it all. And then I started hanging around the sets, and I started working with filmmakers and actors and so on. And I began to realize, no, that's not true. The person in the filmmaking industry, business, that's most like the novelist is the actor, because the actor inhabits the characters. The actor, that's why they're so insecure, because they don't know what they look like, really, except in a photo, on screen. There's a nice, interesting story I remember from an interview of Michael Ondaatje after the making of The English Patient. And the interview was conducted, it was for like Bomb Magazine or something like that. The interview was conducted by Willem Dafoe, who had played a character in the film of The English Patient. And he asked Michael, what does it feel like to have your characters embodied by someone like me, for instance? He was thinking, how's it feel to have your character that you invented in your mind, now wearing my body, as it were? And Ondaatje answered very honestly and very, very sweetly and sincerely. He said, actually, the truth is, I don't know what my characters look like because I'm inside them. And I don't know what I look like because I'm inside me. And he was saying a really basic fundamental truth about both the writing process and also about identity. And we don't know what it's like to be in a room with ourselves. We've never been in that room. That's why we're always trying to catch a glimpse of ourselves as we pass, you know, a plate glass window or a mirror or something. I want to see what I look like when I'm not looking. Impossible. Forget it. You don't know, and you never will know, what it's like to be in a room with you. And actors embody their characters and look out of their eyes the same way a novelist embodies his characters or her characters and looks out of their eyes. And that's the trick. I mean, no, it's not a trick. That's the task. You have to, I had to go to the kid and look out at the world through his eyes. And it's not a matter of research. It's a matter, I think, and it's not a matter of identification. You don't identify with him. I don't say he's like me. He's not like me. That's the whole point. He's not at all like me. I have to be like him. I have to go there and be like him. And look out of the world. And that is a leap of the imagination. And in this novel, I didn't have any problem with the kid going there. I mean, I've been really stupid at different points in my life. I've done some really dumb things, and as we all have, everyone in this room has. And if you deny it, that's a dumb thing. we all have. And so it wasn't that hard to him. I mean, he's like my dumb cousin, you know. He's like the kid down the block. He's like so many people I have known or feared my own kids or others would turn into. And it's so easy to turn into that dumb person, to make that kind of mistake, to end up busted for, you know, statutory rape and end up, you know, in underneath the causeway. It's so easy to do that. That was not a problem for me. And it wasn't a problem for lots of the other characters, and even the second most important character, this professor that I think you mentioned in the opening remark, is this character who is an academic who weighs a quarter of a ton. He's a morbidly obese man who lives in his head. The smartest man in South Florida, you know. Validated by his membership in Mensa and every other association he might have, who has a theory about everything. I've known people like that. I've spent a lot of time in universities. I know a lot of academics who live in their head who have a lot of secrets, and the secrets don't communicate with one another. And so compartmental life is not that unfamiliar. So it isn't that hard to make that jump. But I confess that this novel... And I'm confessing it. I just started, actually. Yesterday is the first time I spoke of it in public. Today, and second time. There's one character in here I really, for the first time in my life, could not enter, could not inhabit. And this may tell me more about the process that you've questioned here than the fact that there were so many others I could enter who were unlike myself, women and African Americans and all kinds of, and Africans and other kinds of characters I had no problem with. But this is a sociopathic pedophile, this character in the novel. And he's there, he's present, he's a minor character, but he's there. And he's, you know, he's almost satanic. I mean, yet I don't make anything out of it. I mean, he's just there. But I couldn't get inside his head. And it's the first time in my 50 years of writing fiction that I ever had a character in a novel whose eyes I couldn't look out of, who I couldn't inhabit in some way or other. And I'm not sure, and I'm saying this quite honestly, I don't know what to make of it. I'm still puzzled by it. I'm still pondering it. And I don't know if it's a failure of my imagination, or am I dealing with someone, a phenomenon, that is a psychology which is beyond the grasp of the human imagination? I don't think so. There's something that I'm bringing to the experience that is perhaps socially determined in some way. I don't know. I really don't know. But it was the first time and the only time in my whole writing life where I've ever come up against a character where I couldn't see the world from his or her eyes. And I've worked, you know, the margins over the years with a lot of characters who most people would find really difficult to enter into. And this has happened. So your question points to a quandary that I, not a quandary, it's a puzzle for me, and one I intend to try to sort out over the next few years as I think about this, because I really did push myself out as far as I've ever gone in my life to people who were so different from me, and then I found a wall, and I'm not sure how to get over that wall, or whether it's a self-imposed wall, a self-created wall. I'm not sure. I don't know. I really don't know. Well, that was a kind of a bummer, wasn't it? Sorry you asked that question. Now, aren't you? Would someone like to take me in another direction?
Well, with the characters, can I imagine who the kid is? And my friend might imagine him as Brad Pitt, and I think he's Ryan Gosling or something, or Nick Nolte. No, wait.
No.
Do you have that in mind when you write a story?
You mean an actor, an actual actor?
No, well, but just leave it to me to.
Well, you see, fiction is an interactive activity, unlike film. The reader brings to the act of reading a fiction, a story, a novel, his or her own dreams and memories and imaginings and desires and fears, landscapes, all the things, all the experiences that the reader has had, as the writer does when the writer's composing it. And then there's this encounter, you know, that occurs, you know, between my secret inner life and the reader's secret inner life. And it takes place on the page. And then there's this kind of combustion that creates the fictional world. And it causes sustained visual and oral hallucinations. I mean, that's what reading fiction is. It's out-of-the-body travel. And it's sustained and it's controlled to some degree. But it's a shared enterprise between the reader and the writer. When I write, I am seeing things and I'm hearing things. Dialogue is oral hallucination. And most description, exposition, etc., is visual hallucination. For me, I see it. If I can't see it, I can't write it. It means I'm really kidding myself. It means I'm afraid of the subject. It means all kinds of things about my relation to the material. But if I can see it, I can set it down. If I can hear it, I can set it down. Well, okay, you bring your life's experience to that moment when you pick up the book, open it up, it's at page one, open up, say da-da-da-da-da. Then you're bringing everything you have ever experienced to bear on that. And we're collaborating in a funny, invisible way. You're thousands of miles away from me. You might even be reading it in another language. And we're collaborating in a shared hallucination, in a sense. And it's magical. It's wonderful. But it's interactive. And it's very different from film in that sense. Because film, you're a passive consumer of it, and you're locked into the time of it, 2 hours. You can't stop it. Well, you can stop it with your remote, maybe, but you can't stop your perception. Your perceptual, you know, apparatus here just is locked into the unfolding of the film, or whatever medium it comes to you, if it comes to you in that digitalized format. As well. And you're stuck with what's on the screen. You can't change it. You can't bring your memory of, you know, those mountains you saw in the distance and the field that rolled towards you and then the little house that was in front of you where you grew up. You can't project that back onto the film where you can in a novel. And when that fierce father comes storming into the room, you can't say, "Oh God, here comes Dad." You know, you can't put your own dad on top of it. You're a very passive consumer of it. It's a wholly different relation to narrative, to story than fiction. For me, fiction is the most democratic of art forms for lots of reasons. But one of them is this: that it's mutually, we create it together. The act of reading is a shared creative act, I think. Yes.
Did you ever go down under the causeway?
Oh, yes, because I could walk over to the causeway. Did I ever go down underneath is what she asked. And and visit these guys. I didn't do a lot of it. I wasn't trying to approach this as an investigative journalist or a sociologist or anything. I went there as a novelist. I wanted to know what it smelled like and what it was like to be under a causeway with cars roaring overhead 24 hours a day. Trucks and cars and motorcycles and buses, you know, just boom, boom, boom. And while you're down there on this concrete pier with these rusting steel pylons holding up the road and this, you know, right crowded up together, these I wanted to see what it looked like, you know, with these shanties crowded up against each other. And you know, and it was very instructive for a novelist. I mean, it was vivid. I mean, here's the bay, and the tide comes in, the bay comes up. Make sure you pitch your tent away from high tide. And, you know, polyurethane shelters over old, you know, scrapped up 2x4s from the, you know, driftwood. It was a community, and I kind of wanted to see that too. You know, they had organized, as human beings inevitably do, into a structured community. I mean, there was a guy down there who was entrepreneurial kind of man who had got a diesel generator so that I could charge the batteries of their GPS anklets. Because if your battery goes dead, then you're going to get busted because you go off the screen and they think you've escaped. And so this guy was, you know, selling time on his diesel generator to charge the batteries. And then it was this wonderful hierarchy too, which was very interesting to me. And that kind of crept into the novel. But I was approaching it as a novelist in the research. The thing about being a novelist in a funny way, and I know some of you who are novelists in the room here understand this, you're thought to be an expert on the subject very briefly, you know. And you know you only learned as much as you needed to learn in order to make the story plausible, in order to make it believable, in order for that collision that I was describing earlier to take place, because you trust the reader's going to bring a whole lot of information to it too. And so I wasn't trying to become an expert on the subject, and I wasn't trying to provide answers. I wasn't bringing to it an agenda, social or otherwise. I was trying to penetrate a mystery, something that I couldn't otherwise understand except through the rigor and the discipline and the tradition of fiction writing, which makes me, you know, under its rubric, smarter and more attentive and more honest than I am at any other time in my life. I mean, I think those of us who write fiction seriously understand that. We say, oh, that's why I write fiction. I write fiction because I'm smarter than I am the rest of the time when I'm a little stupid. And I'm also more honest than I am the rest of the time when I always fudge things and I lie a lot. And also I'm more attentive when I'm writing fiction than I am the rest of the time when I'm somewhat distracted and self-absorbed. So that's why we write fiction, I think. It sounds a little pathetic maybe to say, but you know, but it is true. We do it because I'm a better person when I'm writing fiction than I am the rest of the time. I'm a failure at almost everything else. I mean, I know how that sounds. It does sound a little dumb, but it's true on some basic fundamental level. Yeah. One or two more? Yeah.
You were talking about Adam Lloyd. And you said that films aren't as democratic as the written word.
Is that what you're saying?
Just you were saying that, you know, the reader can interpret however and how your hallucination or dream interacts with theirs. Do you feel that Egoyan and Schrader captured somehow that ambiguity, that collision visually, or
no? I think it's beyond the capacity for the medium to go there in a way. The thing that the novel does more successfully than any other
medium that we have, any other form of storytelling, I should put it that way, that we have available to us, is that it makes meaningful the subjective experience of another human being. And from Cervantes forward, this is its whole point, is to make the subjective experience of another of an individual human being important. And regardless of class, you know, regardless of any social category you want to attach to that person. And no other medium can quite go there to that degree. And it may be because it doesn't engage the imagination of the viewer in the same way and to the same degree in the creation of the narrative as the fiction does. So,
let me ask you this.
Yes.
When you're writing your book, is it clear to you that when you write, is it clear and then you know that because it's your subjective experience, then that other thing will happen with the audience? So is the story essentially clear to you as you write it for yourself?
Well, the story is almost never clear to me what I'm doing. I mean, my mentor when I was very young was the great Chicago novelist Nelson Algren, and he kind of took me under his wing when I was in my early 20s. And he used to say, a novelist, a writer who knows what he's doing doesn't know very much. And it was true. You have to not know what you're doing, and you have to trust the not knowing. And so there's a lot I don't know at the time. But I, you know, the basic, I've been at this now about 50 years, and I realized recently that there are some things that have changed over those 50 years and some that haven't. And one thing that is constant is that I still don't know what I'm doing any more than I did when I was 22 years old or 21 years old and just beginning. But the difference is that when I was 21 and 22 years old, I didn't trust that. I was afraid of that. And I thought that was a real problem, and I better figure out how to know what I'm doing. But now I'm 71 years old, and I really trust it. And in fact, I make sure that I don't know what I'm doing. I think maybe that's a good note to end. Thank you all. Oh, I was going to read. Let me read one paragraph at least. I mean, come all the way here and not read a paragraph? That's terrible. It's actually two paragraphs, if you don't mind. I can indulge myself a little bit. Kind of give you a taste of the language, at least. This is a kid charging the battery of his GPS unit, his anklet. He happens to be, he's not under the causeway at this time, he's somewhere else, and there's no other references you need to understand, but it gives you his world. The kid unravels a stringy black charger cable and jacks one end into a socket on the anklet and plugs the other into an electrical outlet bolted to the table's 2x4 wood frame. The metal shackle presses against the bare skin of his leg, and the kid feels the juice flow not from the battery into his body, but from his body out to the battery, as if instead of being filled with electrical power, he were being drained of it. It happens every time he gets the battery charged. He imagines his way from his body out to what he rationally knows is the source of the current, but visualizes it instead as the ultimate receptacle for the current, as if he and millions like him were spinning the turbines at the farthest end of the line, and not vice versa. He sits on the pier and stares at the dime-sized battery linking his skin to the charger cord. It takes half an hour to fully charge his monitor battery, and during that half hour, the kid feels intimately connected to the millions of other convicted sex offenders, young and old and in between. Rapists and child abusers and men who expose their genitals on a bus, public masturbators, voyeurs and escalator gropers, compulsive seducers of teenaged boys,
coaches who couldn't keep their hands off their athletes, men who talked dirty in internet chat rooms to people they thought were teenaged girls and then arranged to meet them for sex, fathers and uncles who drunkenly reached out for their teenage daughters as they passed by the sofa, porn addicts and fantasists lost in the misty zone between reality and imagery, no longer able to tell the difference, all of whom at this moment have plugged their electronic shackles into outlets and are sitting in the bedrooms, living rooms, and basements of houses and apartments and mobile homes, in garages, homeless shelters, public parks, in airports and train stations, in waiting rooms, offices, and the back rooms of fast food restaurants and under causeways and overpasses. As if they were all trembling leaves on the branches, large and small, of a vast electrical tree that casts its shadow across the entire country.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.